Well, it's a great pleasure this week to have Katie Marquis as my nostalgia interviewee. And Katie, now we've known each other for a few years. Well, of course, you teach my daughters at a local ballet school. But do you want to say a little bit about what it is that you do here in Canterbury?
Yes, I run Dance Warehouse, which is a local dance school, where I was myself a pupil way back in the day, in 1995 when it opened. And then I went off and had a short dancing career. And then I've come back to, well, initially teach at the school, and then after about 8 or 10 years, then I took over the school when the previous owner retired.
Now, it's funny when that happens, the idea of working somewhere where you were once a pupil. I mean, I know plenty of people I, for example, went to university with who have gone back, say, to their former primary or secondary school and are teaching the same subjects that they perhaps did at university.
Yes.
And then all, and maybe even still working with their original teachers. And it's, and I suppose looking back, it must feel a little bit strange, sort of you're with all these different spaces commingling.
Yes, it has. I mean, a lot of the teachers now that when I first came back to teach have since retired, but it was quite nice because we've been quite a close team because of that. They've known my background and obviously I've known theirs, and we've known each other for obviously 28 years. So it does make for a very family atmosphere at Dance Warehouse, which has been nice. It hasn't actually, and I've been quite surprised about it, ever been awkward from that sense. I think we've always had a mutual respect. I think that's something that probably comes in the dance world as well.
But I suppose if somebody had said to you back then that one day you'd be, you know, running the place, you'd be, you know, doing all the teaching that you were the beneficiary of, you probably would have thought, oh, that's, you know, that's never going to happen.
Yes, yeah, true, it's true. I have always, though, from a very young age, aspired to, I always said, I think from about the age of 8, I one day announced I was going to go to the Royal Ballet School, dance in the company, and then own my own dance school. Obviously, I never imagined that would be the school where I trained myself, but that has always been my dream. So I've been lucky enough to be able to actually, you know, realise that dream in a way.
Well, that's phenomenal, because we were, before we started recording, we were talking about that sort of notion of, you know, at different ages and different stages, sometimes realising a dream that you, in my case, it was always radio. And I guess I'm sort of doing that now, but not necessarily when I thought I'd be doing it, because I'm a lot older than I was when that dream started to emerge. But as you sort of look back, do you sort of feel that it's all falling into place? Almost that, not destiny, but that sense that there was something that was inevitably going to happen, and it's happened in the way that you couldn't, or maybe you could have imagined?
It's a very good question, actually. I think, yes, I think with the dance world in particular, and I guess a lot of other similar worlds, such as athletes and sports people, you're so focused from the start that. And also, I'm, as a person, I'm a very determined person. So once I've got an idea that's fixed, I sort of stick to that and I focus on that and I don't really think about anything else. So I think probably the way in which the dance world works as well, if you are lucky enough to succeed in that, then actually that sort of just becomes part of course. And a lot of dancers do end up teaching. So I think I've been very lucky, obviously, to be able to have the opportunity to do everything that I've wanted to do. But I think probably... Yeah, it was probably destiny.
Well, although I kind of thought I should be taking notes, so although I'll have plenty of opportunity listening back. But I find that really significant, because it sounds like from a very young age, you can perhaps say how young, this was the dream that you wanted to accomplish.
Yes, I mean, I started ballet when I was 5, which nowadays is actually quite late, because obviously children start from 2 or 3. But back in that, in the, you know, 90s, early 90s, when I, or no, even early before that, 80s, when I started dancing, you know, people started dancing much later in life. But I would say, yes, literally, I think I just got hooked by it. I really loved it. I'd always wanted to dance. And then I think by the time I was 8, I was a junior associate at the Royal Ballet School. And I think by that point, I was, that's, that was my decision made. That's what I wanted to do. I've never changed my mind since.
Well, no, and I always, somebody once said to me that they said, you know, when you're older, will you look back and think, oh, I wish I'd done more work or gone to work more? And I'm thinking, that's the difference between a job and a vocation, because there are things that I do. I mean, I've blurred the lines. I mean, I do lots of cinema going. I do reviews and, you know, do the podcast. But I don't sort of think, oh, I've got to do this today. It's just sort of, you know, if I didn't do it, even when I'm really busy with teaching or other duties, if I'm not doing the podcast, I feel that there's something really big missing and I have to, you know, find a way of fitting that in. So I think if you have a passion for something, you're always going to find a route towards doing it. But it sounds like it was inevitable and very natural from what you're saying, organic even.
Yes, it was. And I totally agree. I feel very lucky that it is a vocation, but actually it's my job as well, obviously at the same time, that I'm lucky enough to be able to do something that I absolutely love. Yeah. In fact, somebody said to me the other day that, asked me, you know, if I hadn't gone into dance or if I wasn't able to carry on teaching now, what would I do? And I actually couldn't answer the question because I couldn't think of anything else that I would want to do. So yes, it's just, I think it's been something that I've caught on to for some reason when I was younger and just never changed my mind.
And do you find that, you know, if you're still in touch with, you know, friends from those days, do they sort of say, we always knew this was going to happen? Because I always find those sort of interactions with peers, with contemporaries, you know, sometimes when you're very young, people have all sorts of ideas and thoughts and advice and you shrug it off, or if you don't know your own path, you don't necessarily take on board what people have to tell you. But sort of looking back at people who you grew up with, very much of a view that, you know, this was something that was a very extraordinary talent and it was obvious that you were going to be cultivating that.
I think so. I mean, I unfortunately have lost contact with a lot of my sort of primary school and secondary school friends, and I've kept more in contact with my friends that I danced with and trained with more so. But I have kept in contact actually with one of my primary school teachers. And I think if you asked her that question, she would probably say, definitely without a shadow of a doubt, we could have seen Katie going down that route. So, yeah, I think people wouldn't be surprised, to be honest. And members of my family definitely weren't surprised when I kept on with the dancing.
Yeah. And it's the equivalent of finding, as I did during lockdown, all my old school reports. Yeah. And you look at it with some trepidation, but you know, that sort of sense of, you know, I'm sufficiently intrigued to see what my teachers thought of me all those years ago and how that connects or not with my own sense of self during that period. Yes. But often you see those patterns.
Yes.
And I think in my case, you know, sometimes it's almost like I would sort of say I've got certain like extrovert tendencies, but also very shy sort of at the same time. And it's like at different stages in life, they manifest themselves in different ways. And then when you're in the right space, you can, you know, completely own that stage, literally in the case of what you do.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all of my school reports were said very quiet in class. Yeah. Yeah. But actually now, if somebody saw me teaching, they say the exact opposite. Yeah. So, yeah, no, absolutely.
I love that sort of wrong footing of expectations to self as well, not just in the views of, in the eyes of others. I always think on like social media, the way that my students see me in classroom, or the way people I grew up with or family see me, or my children see me, and then what might be projected in another space in terms of what I wear, what I do, the sort of, you know, going to watch lots of different films or so on, people must think, gosh, you know, and trying to sort of think, is that the same person? And in some cases, maybe it is, rather than, I didn't know he did that kind of thing.
No,
but you must have a similar...
No, I do. And I think everybody sees this persona of Miss Katie, as I'm called at Dance Warehouse, you know, as one sort of personality. He's probably very positive. But actually, if they saw me at home and in my, you know, my private life, they're probably quite surprised, actually, what I am like. So, yeah, I think I agree, totally. Yeah.
Well, it's for you to divulge how much of that other life you went in. But do you want to say a bit about where you grew up? Because am I right in thinking that you're from this part of the world, from Kent?
I am. I was born in Canterbury. So, and then I started to grow up in Canterbury, but my family actually moved to the Netherlands for a year when I was about two, because of my father's work at the time. He had a year with the same company he was working with here over there. Unfortunately, I don't remember much about that because obviously I was so young. And then we came back, we carried on living in Canterbury. My brother started school and then I started school. I went to both primary school and secondary school in Canterbury. And then I left the Langton when I was 16 because I was lucky enough to get into full-time dance school. And so I went to the Royal Ballet School for 3 years at the age of 16. So moving up to London and moving away from family at 16 was quite a move in itself. And then after that, I had a short career performing with a touring ballet company. So we toured the UK and the Channel Islands, which is where I met my husband, because he's also into theatre. He's a stage manager and he was touring with the same ballet company that I was dancing with. And we say the rest is history from that point of view. And then I came back after I sort of finished teaching to then, because Alison, who set up Dance Warehouse, then asked me if I'd like to come back and teach for her. And I did that, and then I've just done really the full circle from there.
But it sounds like on all everything that you've said, every answer you've given, just shows that, you know, even meeting your husband while you're on a ballet tour, who's working in the same kind of area, it kind of feels that this is all a perfect synchronicity.
I'm a great believer in fate, and I'm a great believer in just letting nature take its course and fate letting, you know, things happen. So, yes, definitely.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about ballet and life beyond, or even at ballet school in a moment. But sticking with childhood, were there any other interests? Although, I suppose, anyway, that's the wrong question to ask you after what you've just said. But, I mean, for me, it was obviously the charts, the radio, you know, music. That not just the music, but the way that the music was done. It was the way that a particular radio presenter might make that all come alive, feel very, you know, almost like hitting that zeitgeist that, you know, on this particular day, this is the thing that people are switching their radios on to listen to, that kind of thing. And that was always the playground conversation in the days before social media. So we'd hear something on the radio and we'd all be talking about it in the school playground, something that my own children don't do because it's a different kind of age. But do you have any sort of memories along those lines, maybe with radio or TV or literature?
To be honest, because, as I say, from quite a young age, I was out dancing most days, so I didn't have a great deal of spare time, but I used to like, and still do when I have the time, doing arts and crafts and sewing and that kind of thing. Obviously playing with friends when I was younger as well, but to be honest, most of my time was taken up dancing, so I didn't really have a great deal of time. I mean, I've always been into radio more than probably listening to particular artists with music, because I tend to have it on in the background, especially if, you know, I'm in the car, or when I was younger, you know, if my husband was away on tour, it's kind of good company as well, because you get the conversational aspect of the radio as well as the music. So yes, I guess I didn't really have a great deal of spare time, which sounds awful, although I was very obsessive at one point with the Agatha Christie Hercule Poirot series with John Suchet. David Suchet. And I used to watch those avidly as a younger child, so yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, because you see, it's those, and of course also, but when you can watch all those things now, you know, it's almost too easy at the touch of a button. I find that. Like, I used to go on these great, in my office here, you can see all these videos. Yeah. It was like this pilgrimage to go and purchase something that you want. Whereas it's almost too easy these days. But as you say, watching on a particular day and fitting your life schedule around a particular, like, Sunday evening or something, you know, and actually making sure that everything else is moved sufficiently. So, you know, that 1 hour on a Sunday or whatever it is your sort of precious time. That feels far more rewarding than now, when you're like, oh, I'll watch it on catch up. I'll watch it when I'll watch it next weekend, or I'll watch it when I've got a chance.
No, absolutely.
Because you can't share it in quite the same way as you would when everyone was watching it at the same time, and everyone's, you know, no one is one episode ahead or behind anybody else.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, as you say, nowadays with all the streaming as well, it's a very different world. I think my guilty pleasure now, if I have time on a Friday night when I get home from work, is to watch Graham Norton as well, because I find his show fascinating and all the different celebrities that he interviews as well.
But also, we were talking about persona a moment ago, personae, and I think you find that with something like the Graham Norton show, because it's always watching these people who you associate with film or music or television, but interacting with each other. I'm sure, obviously, it's all planned in advance, and what you get is a very edited, you know, version. But watching people do things, or laughing at other guests who they wouldn't meet in any other context. Like, you might have, like, I don't know, Robert De Niro mixed with a British, you know, stand-up comedian or something, and you're feeling, you know, these two people are only here because of the Graham Norton show. But then doing things outside of the ordinary, or you sort of see the way that persona is perhaps either augmented or shattered in some ways, as somebody comes alive in a way that you've never seen them do before in their film or TV role or whatever.
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely, and I've been lucky enough to meet a few sort of, well, celebrities and also obviously well-known dancers from the dance world, because I remember as a student I was lucky enough to help out at a British Red Cross, Cross charity gala at the London Palladium, and obviously there were a lot of celebrities who were hosting it and a lot of dancers who were performing, and that was interesting because, as you say, you see these celebrities on the TV or you hear them in interview and you think they're going to be one sort of character, and then you actually meet them and think, oh gosh, you're quite different from how I imagined, sometimes in a nice way and sometimes in a slightly surprising way the other way as well.
Yeah, there's that old adage, isn't there, about meeting your heroes.
Yes.
And how sometimes you can be disappointed because, you know, you put that person on a pedestal and there's a lot of yourself in that person because maybe you've studied them or you've bought all their films, and then you meet them and you think, oh, you're not how I expected.
Yes.
But without naming names, unless you want to, was that your sense as well? Did you sort of have some incredible experiences?
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I won't name names, yeah. but yes, no, definitely. I think there were some very... well-known dancers at the gala that, you know, I've almost idolised. I think, wow, they've been so talented. And actually, as a personality, they had quite an ego. And for me, that's always disappointing because I think as an artist, that's, you know, if you're that talented, that's amazing. But I think you should be very gracious as well to your audience. And I think in the same way, any celebrity should be, because without their audience and without their fans, they aren't, at the end of the day, the person that they are as well.
So growing up, you mentioned that you were always so full in terms of your time commitments with dancing that you couldn't do other things. But what about in terms of wider schoolwork? Because that juxtaposition of going far and wide with your, you know, with the dancing, but balancing that with the more routine sort of school days and all the sort of responsibilities and commitments there. How did that work?
To be honest, so long ago, I probably can hardly remember. But I don't ever remember struggling to actually cope with the workload. I mean, I was very lucky in my primary school years. My parents were very good at helping me with all the sort of homework and the projects that we had to do. They were very hands-on and helping both my brother and I with that. And I think at secondary school, it was just a matter of time management and organisation. You know, I'd be out till sometimes quite late dancing, but then being able to either do that homework before I went out or when I came home, I don't ever remember it, to be honest, being a huge problem. But I think that's the one thing, I know I always say this to our older students as well, is with dance particularly, you know, you're learning so many interchangeable skills, one of which is time management. So you have to be disciplined as a dancer to be able to have time to practice the dance like you would a musical instrument, but also you have to obviously manage your, as you say, your schoolwork, which again, as I always say to my students, is very important too, because even if you make it as a dancer, it takes one injury or a change of circumstances such as the pandemic, when obviously a lot of dancers were suddenly found themselves out of work, and you need to fall back on those academics. So I think it was always drummed into me as well that, you know, obviously the academics were very important. Then when I went away to train as a dancer, we did do some A-levels at the same time as the teaching diploma that I was doing. So again, that was quite hard because we probably didn't, because of our full-time training, which was 6 days a week, have as much time as an A-level student in a normal academic school would be. So it was then that discipline of having to put in the extra hours at the weekend to study, because I was doing a language at A-level. I did French, so alongside dance. So it's, you know, obviously that needed practice as well.
See, I always find that the big paradox, because sometimes I find that the busier I am with my work, and I guess, you know, looking back at it, you could say the same with school, somehow having something else, I wouldn't even say on the back burner, because I suppose sometimes you sort of think, which is the primary thing? Is it the dancing or the schoolwork? Because the two can work in tandem. It's not as though you have to say, this is the time allotted to one and that the other. Yeah. I mean, often you have to day to day, because you've got to do something between the hours of 4 and 5 or whatever. But often it's seamless. And sometimes if you're really passionate about something, it will all integrate.
Yes.
And I find that even with my own children sometimes, it's, you know, sometimes you find that the busier you are, sometimes the easier that everything else slots into place. Whereas I know people who'll say, oh, if they do, I mean, I get very little sleep, and I'll be frank, I go to bed way too late.
So do I, but
this is the thing. People who say to me, oh, they have to get their 8 hours, they all seem to be really tired. And they say, oh, I can't stay out long because whatever reason. And I'm thinking, I may have had 4 hours, 4.5 hours sleep, and I've been going all day. And I, you know, I got this energy, you know, which has come from somewhere. And I always find that the thing. We all have to find our niche. And I think my mistake was going through school often and almost like thinking, oh, because that person said that they did X number of hours of homework yesterday, I'll have to do the same amount of hours, otherwise I'll feel, you know. So it's like competitive, but also that sense of almost wanting to show that you're serious about what you do. But I look back now and I think, you know, the path that I followed was quite a bespoke one. And, you know, that you're sort of comparing what somebody else is doing, but actually that will only get you so far.
Yes, no, I agree. And I think particularly the teacher's course that I did at the Royal Ballet School was brilliant at at helping us with time management, because, for example, in our third year, we'd have three teaching exams in 1 week, and it really had to focus your mind on, as you say, prioritising what needed doing at that point. And I feel that's actually stood me in good stead afterwards as well, you know, since in life, just generally focusing, prioritising, saying, well, this is what needs doing first, and then I can focus on that. Or actually, I need to think about both of those at the same time.
And actually that sort of time management, I think, is important, because I suppose with anything, I work in a religious studies department, but I guess in the same way that, you know, people don't tend to bracket out whether it's, you know, a religious faith or any commitments that anyone has. Of course, in reality, you're always doing all those things at once. You have to pay your taxes and prepare for your classes and listen to the radio, watch Graham Norton, or whatever it might be. And often, you know, you have to integrate all these things. And you can be focused on particular things, but you never know what the next letter or email will bring. And suddenly, as I do at work, you come in thinking, I want to do X, Y, Z today. And you get an email and you think, right, you know, all out the window.
I often have days like that myself as well, And I think sometimes the parents of the students at Dartswell has to think, we come in, we teach, and that's it. And they forget, like, academic teachers as well, as you say, they have that lesson planning to do before, and then the reflection of their class afterwards, and, you know, what moving forwards, what's going to happen next with particular classes or projects that they're doing as well. So
yes, that's true. And of course, that's the thing, that when you're young and you have this dream, and you had a dream which you fulfilled, I suppose that you necessarily didn't imagine all the admin that goes with it. I suppose that's the bit that maybe wasn't part of the dream.
No, definitely not. And I think more so since the pandemic, because everything's become very digital, I think it's created in some ways more admin, because I'm receiving far more emails than probably we ever did before the pandemic, and, you know, and other things like that as well.
I've often joked to people, I said that, you know, I love my profession, but I didn't enter it to write module specs, you know. But actually, and often the people who do, and I've got a colleague who's just retired, who was until just a week or so ago our big quality assurance chief, and I've got to know him quite well, because he writes a lot of fiction, young adult fiction particularly. And he has this huge interest in film, and suddenly you sort of see that everyone has a different side. That you think, oh, that person deals with quantifying things and, you know, dealing with, you know, university procedures and protocols, but actually everyone has a hinterland, but often that hinterland defines them more than the thing that 90% of people associate with them.
Yes, absolutely. I think people don't quite realise, actually, I think to be a dance teacher, you have to obviously be very good at admin, but you also have to be good at sound engineering in a way, because we have to edit music and sometimes videos as well now. Since the pandemic, obviously, you have to be good at choreography. You have to be able to have good communication, social skills to obviously work with your customers. And there's lots of different aspects that people probably don't even consider.
No, and I can vouch for what you just said, because I've often seen, of course, that if you haven't got a pianist in the room, of course, you have to operate all the controls.
Yes.
And actually ensure that the right piece of music is lined up at the right moment. So all the dancers are in coordination, and I guess that doesn't happen randomly.
No, but also it's much easier nowadays with digital music and playing it from an iPad or an iPhone. Or whereas when I first started teaching, we had cassette tapes, and that used to be a nightmare, because you could spend half the lesson fast forwarding and rewinding to try and find the right spot, and then the cassette tape would come out and you'd have to wind it back in again with a pencil. And then we moved on to CDs, and that was slightly easier, but then they'd get scratched, and then then they'd be useless. And so now, with the age of digital music, it's actually a lot easier.
You've just offered an encapsulation of my entire life. Growing up with cassette, even I'm just about remember those very big reels that people would use for recording, that you'd associate with, like, filmmakers. Film, you know, almost like cutting out the the strips and, you know, using some form of adhesive to, you know, to put them together in the right place. And then cassette. I was very late to CD, probably maybe even early 2000s. Very odd, because I used to record lots of stuff on the radio on cassette until not that many years ago, and now finally succumbed to an age of streaming and doing a podcast. But, you know, editing using digital technology rather than having the old, like, tape to tape type thing, the old ghetto blast or whatever it was called, of having, you know, one reel and another reel and recording from one to the other. Painstaking work, but a lot more craftsmanship in it, perhaps, because it was, you know, you had to be really invested in it to make it work.
No, absolutely. And we used to have a old record player as well in our family. And I mean, and my grandmother's 105. And when I think of the changes that she's seen during her lifetime, as you say, not only with music, but also with things like when we're often taking family photographs on her, you know, birthday, you know, think of even the changes within film development and photos and again, the digital age. It's just incredible to think, you know, how technology really has advanced our lives, really.
That's a phenomenal. So you have a 105-year-old, so she would have been born end of the First World War.
Yes.
That's phenomenal. So I'm just sort of showing that my maths is obviously my 4.5 hours sleep obviously hasn't. But that is incredible. Yeah,
she is. She's absolutely incredible, and you know, she's supported me along a lot. You know, and obviously my brother with his career as well. And I think, you know, as a family, she's just an amazing lady.
Yeah. But I suppose also because obviously nostalgia is what's underpinning this conversation. But actually having a family member who goes back quite that far.
Amazing photographs. Yeah. I mean, she's got one photograph from when the soldiers went off to war because her husband actually fought in the Second World War and ended up actually in a prisoner of war camp. But there's a photograph of all of them leaving by train to go off to war. And I just think photos like that, we know obviously we want to keep, but we're trying to get her to now label them up so we know who everybody is as well in these photographs, you know, before it's too late.
So it sounds like she's still very sharp.
Oh, she's very sharp, absolutely. No, she's very there.
Yeah. Do you know, I always find this because, you know, with photographs, I always think it's very funny that when people start posting their university pictures, you always see the same sort of thing. It's always people in a more like social setting, like in a down the union bar type thing. But nobody ever, and for reasons that are perhaps obvious, but nobody sort of has pictures of, for example, the lectures that they went to, which is ostensibly the reason they went to university.
Yeah.
So you go to university to do that, but there's no pictures of you in that setting. You've just got the pictures of people drunk and, you know, so on. But if you're at a conference sometimes, you often like take pictures of the speaker and say, oh, you know, and then post it on Twitter or something and say, this person just given this magnificent 20-minute speech and all the rest of it. But you don't do it, you know, my own students don't, to my knowledge, you know, film me in a classroom setting, and there are obvious reasons why that is so. But I find, in terms of nostalgia, that the way that sometimes there are certain things from the past that we have visual representations of, but they're not always the things that connect with our own memories of those events.
No, it's very true. I mean, I look back at the photo albums I kept from when I was a dance student, and I think, although there are obviously dancing photographs from occasions like graduation and other events that we did in other shows, I think you're right, most of the photographs are of social events when we'd been out as students or other gatherings, whereas now actually it's quite different because for dance students a lot of them have an Instagram account, so they'll be constantly photographing and filming themselves to sort of almost display their talents to potential, you know, employers and potential schools that might be interested in them as well. So it's a very different life nowadays. Yeah. But I agree.
But also very immediate in the sense that now it's almost as though the moment something happens, you have to disseminate it.
Yes.
Whereas the days of having an event, and the same with radio programmes, that somebody would write into the programme, but somebody would say something on a Monday, and it might be the Thursday before that got, you know, into the post, and the presenter would be reading it out. Whereas now, of course, they'll play a record, and by the time the record's finished, half a dozen people have already started commenting on that first record in the programme.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly thinking, that shift is... And it's a good thing, but there's also part of me that feels it's a bit too immediate.
Yes, sometimes I agree. And I think I agree from the point of view of things like emails as well, because people expect a response all the time straight away.
Yeah.
And I think that puts a lot of pressure on obviously people that are having to deal with all the admin for their companies or their businesses as well.
Yeah.
So it is, I agree. Life has become very instant. And I feel that as well from the children's attitudes, perhaps because of what they see on the TV with all the reality TV shows. Things like Britain's Got Talent, they just see people go up, stand on the stage, sing a song or do a dance or showcase their talent, and then they're suddenly the next minute they're famous and they expect that that's what's going to happen to them. And actually, you know, with the work that I do, then we're having to constantly try and educate them into the fact that actually there's a process and there's a training process, and it's not that instant process that they'd like it to be. It does take time, but it's a worthwhile process, but obviously it's not as instant as they think. It should be.
So have you found that, particularly in recent years, of some of the pupils who imagine that literally that's the, that, you know, it could happen overnight kind of thing?
Well, sometimes. I mean, luckily not too often, because I think a lot of the families that bring their children to dance obviously have had a dance background as well before, but I think it's becoming more so with teenagers, yes.
They get actually thinking about it. I mean, I've had, you know, students in the past who sometimes will suddenly say, like in their third year, they say, oh, what do I have to do to get a first? And you're thinking, ooh, you know, there's all sorts of answers. Then you're thinking, but interesting that it's almost the expectation that it can happen if you suddenly, if you want it to happen, it'll happen. But, you know, you have to do it when the infrastructure is in place. And sometimes almost that sense that suddenly you can achieve what you want at the time that's suited, you know, suitable for you. But I might look and say, ah, but if you'd asked that question 2 years ago, then we know we could have put things in place. But it's the whole issue of realistic expectations.
Well, absolutely, and that's the same, and that's why when we do our ballet exams, for example, I think some children obviously find that quite stressful because they get quite anxious about the idea of being assessed. But actually it's quite a good process because it teaches children exactly what you've just said. It teaches them that they've got to, you know, commit to what they're doing, and as you say, work from the very beginning rather than try and leave it to the last minute to learn their dances and their dance routines and exercises. And I think that's very, again, for young people, that's a very useful skill to be able to have, and a very important one in life.
Yeah. And I also think that those people who are on the journey but appreciate and savour the journey, rather than those who just say it's all about the end point, and once the end point is reached, then you move on to the next goal. Those people who see the journey, you know, will be far more nourished in that sense, because you appreciate what you're doing. Even if the goal doesn't work out for you, you're on the right path, and you can savour it. I always joke with the students that, you know, there will be some who will only be interested in a topic. I mean, I have wonderful students, but, you know, some would be like, you know, they're doing it for credit. Once the module's over, they move on to something else. Or when they get their degree, they move on to something else. And there'll be others who never get out of their system, you know, in a way that they're interested in the journey there, the circuitous journey of life, rather than it all being about outcomes.
Yes.
And I think, and what you need in reality, of course, are the two together. They need to work to as far as possible in harmony.
In tandem, I completely agree. And we've had quite a few students who've, you know, aspired to be professional dancers, and unfortunately it hasn't quite happened for them. But actually they've kept on, you know, with their dance in later life. When they've gone off to university, they've kept dancing because they find it, you know, a good release in their lifestyles, or they just simply enjoy it. And also it's introducing them to the theatre, to being audiences for the theatre, which is equally as important, you know, as well. So I feel, yes, I totally agree. It's the journey, and it's what that journey teaches you, as opposed to just, as you say, the end point, definitely.
And you have lots of pupils, by the sign of it, you do, who get in touch or stay in touch afterwards, and because the journey for them, either for themselves or maybe for their children, you know, is continuing, and they want to, you know, what they've learned through your school, for example, has impacted on them in their wider lives.
We do. We have quite a few that keep in contact. I mean, obviously, not everybody does, which is a shame, because it's always nice to know what they go on and do after they've left us. But I think particularly the children that have started dancing probably from the age of 3 and gone all the way up to 18 with us and then left to go to university or do whatever they're doing next, I think they're generally the students that do keep in contact. And again, that's much easier nowadays, obviously, with social media and email and the digital world. And we had a reunion this summer just gone, which was lovely to see some of the students. And it was interesting, actually, how many of them had kept within the, you know, an interest within the arts world as well. So that was nice to see.
And also gratifying from your point of view that, you know, the success stories, you know, the ongoing success stories.
Yeah, no, of course.
But so in your case, so you mentioned that at 16 you went to ballet school. Was university then something that followed from that? Or
no,
what was the route that you took?
That's instead of. So for dance, you tend to study alongside your training, depending on different dance schools. Some carry on with the academics, some just purely focus on the dance. So when I went to the Royal Ballet School, I was doing a 3-year teaching diploma and studying for 2 A-levels at the same time. So then I didn't go on to university after that, because the only problem with being a dancer is that you can't really have a year out, because obviously physically you have to keep in trim as well. So dancers tend to make that choice between a university setting or as they go on to proper vocational dance training. A lot of the full-time schools now are degree courses.
Oh.
So we've just had some students that are going on Now, this last September, they're doing their dance training, but it also gives them a degree at the end of the course, which is obviously fantastic as well. I say long term, when their career is over, then they've got something again academically to fall back on.
Yeah, no, that's so important, because I think you're right, because that's what I was thinking of, that, you know, there are some things that if you don't champion it, nurture it when you're young, then, you know, you're not going to get that chance again in the same kind of way. So so unless you're really committed, as obviously you were, then, you know, obviously then that's something that you have to sort of work on to the maximum level.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you do, I guess, in the same way you do with gymnastics and others, like I say, yeah, other sports, and presumably musicians as well. I'm slightly ignorant on the world of music, but I would imagine it's the same, that you do have to have that focus from quite a young age and that dedication in order to make it to work. And I think if you get to the stage where, as you say, you feel you could possibly do without it in your life, then that's the time to stop. And that's why I would always support a student if they wanted to have a go, whether, you know, it happens for them or not, because actually, as you say, it's kind of a now or never situation where they have to give it a go, and then you can advise them that, well, if it doesn't happen this time, maybe try again, and then if it doesn't happen, then maybe you need to slightly think of a different career path. But that could still involve the arts in a different way, you know, with physios or dance science. There's lots of other branches, or technical theatre as well. So
yeah, I'm always interested in the whole sort of conflation, you know, the teacher pupil, or the, you know, I suppose I'll watch lots of films sometimes, and you think, you know, the Good Will Hunting came up in a conversation I had in the film programme I do, sort of, you know, the teacher and the pupil swap places. But I think in your case, because you were a pupil in the same school that you're now a teacher, are the two roles seamless? Are you, because I suppose it's like me, I always see myself as a student, because I'm always researching the next thing. And if I'm teaching my students, then I'm always going to be teaching them something that I'm learning. So I'm both the student of a particular discipline or subject or whatever, I'm for a book or a course, as well as delivering that. But the two roles work together. One doesn't, you know, what, at a particular moment, one might take priority over the other. If I'm with my students in a room, I'm the teacher. But if I'm here in my office, I feel more like the student. Does that work for you on different levels? Are you always working on these different pathways at the same time?
Yeah, I think we are. And I think when I think about, you know, what I've been teaching now since 2001, so for the last 22 years, when I think about how my teaching style has changed as well, and as you say, constantly progressing. I mean, obviously we go on courses as dance teachers and we keep our CPD up, and it's interesting always to watch other teachers teach and get other ideas. And yet you develop as a person, as you say, as a teacher as well, and I find that fascinating. And even now I'm still learning all the time. And I think, gosh, no, that hasn't worked. What can I do? And then I'll ask another teacher. And that's what's quite nice as well. We often network and have networking events where we can talk to each other and sort of just bounce ideas off each other. And that can be very healthy too as a teacher. But no, definitely. And sometimes children give you ideas.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, learning from the pupils, because I do that. And I often say this to the students, because, you know, often in, if I'm writing a book, I'll often say to the students, you know, or maybe in the acknowledgements, refer to the students, because in some cases, they've made me, you know, there might be something I think, oh, I've got this wonderful idea and I'll teach it to the students because I've got this, you know, fancy idea or something, and the students just look at you thinking, we're not interested in this, but the previous week they were completely galvanized. I'm thinking, so what is it? So often the students have made me realize that something that might have excited me, say, 30 years ago that I'm still interested in may have work then, but maybe, you know, the for example, I do a lot of stuff on myth, and of course students might say, well, if they grow up with Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or something, they haven't got the sort of problem with some of these terms that maybe, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, for what, you know, different ideas presented themselves. So your grandmother would be a fascinating person to talk to, actually, in terms of, you know, all the shifts and currents across the 20th century alone.
Yes.
So have you found then that learning from your pupils is something that happens? You watch and think, gosh, I didn't consciously teach that particular movement or whatever it might be, but you then start to think of new ways of incorporating that, for example, into one of your productions.
I mean, yeah, sometimes we do improvisations within class, and sometimes children are so creative, and I think, wow, where did you even learn that from? Where did that idea spring from? So sometimes, yes, movement-wise, but I think as well, for me, it's they've brought me into the 21st century, probably, because I think, you know, I was born in the 80s, so I think I'm probably quite set in my ways, and as one of my students told me the other day, I'm quite old-fashioned. But actually, they bring me into the 21st century with new images as well. Sometimes they'll say, "Oh yes, Miss Katie, that's just like something," and I think, actually, yes, you're right. And I think sometimes now I talk to them, you know, when they're talking to them about being thinking dancers, about their Wi-Fi, you know, connecting their brain to their legs, and they understand that far more than me saying being a thinking dancer, as I would have probably said 10, 15 years ago. So I think, it's important to move with the times.
Actually, you made me realise something, that often the analogies that I might use in a teaching context might have been ones that I picked up on or was taught myself 30-odd years ago, for example, at university. Yeah. So I'm often referring to things from the 90s or even stuff that I learned in the 90s from, say, the 1970s. Mm. And there was one occasion when a student said that they'd watched this really old horror film. And I thought, 1930s, 40s, how old? And then she described this film, and I thought, hang on, do you mean... And I mentioned that it was called Fallen. And I saw it in the cinema in 1998. and I thought, that's not an old film. And I thought, hang on, she probably wasn't even born then.
No, I know. And that happens to me as well. I mean, I've often mentioned, you know, cassette tapes or VHS tapes. Or even the other day I was saying, you can't be slow like a milk float. And these children were looking at me. And then I suddenly realised they didn't actually understand what that was. And I thought, gosh, now I feel
a
really old.
But you're right. Yeah, growing up, everyone had their milk delivered in a van that would go up the road very slowly.
Yes, I remember it.
But do you find then that, you know, you've been doing the teaching role for many years, are there new sort of productions on the horizon? Do you kind of feel that has your energy, your enthusiasm sort of been maintained over the years? Do you sort of feel that you've got all these too many ideas and too little time in which to follow them through?
That's a good question. I think I would say my interest and my passion hasn't definitely not waned. I think obviously everybody has their good days and their bad days and dips where you're thinking, oh gosh, I don't know how much longer I can do this. But I think something new always comes along, and I say with the new, I think dance science particularly, and the new ideas coming into the dance world, classical ballet isn't classical ballet anymore really. I think there's a lot of, you know, modern takes on particular productions, and also with the technology and the special effects that you can have in theatre now, it's brought theatre into a different era as well, and I think that gives you as an artist new ideas too. So I mean, we do a show every 2 years. At the moment I'm busy planning next year's summer show and thinking, how can I make this more interactive and more immersive and connect with today's audience, which I think is very important as well. So I think I've, because of the progression, I guess, like in many walks of life, you know, I think that's, you know, that's kept me going. And I think, you know, I think the pandemic probably killed my passion a little because of having to go online. But once we've come back out and gone back into the world where there's live theatre, I think it's very exciting again.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because during lockdown, I remember, of course, you were running all those classes online. I mean, that must have been soul-destroying on some levels. I mean,
it certainly was.
Yeah, because, I mean, in my case, I was actually in my office, but it's before we had, it was the 23rd of my parents' wedding anniversary, 23rd of March in 2020. And that was the last day I was in this very office until, I think, the September when I was able to return. Yeah. And I remember all the memos effectively saying, you know, you have to now teach your students online. And I was in my office here and I thought, the students are probably on this very campus, or maybe by that point they'd gone back to their homes or whatever. But I was thinking, how do I do that? And what panicked me is that even though I do a podcast and even though I use technology and didn't consider myself antiquated, I was aware that I had no clue how I could translate my teaching with an audience in front of me to something that could be done virtually. But did you learn anything from lockdown that, you know, as you say, it was horrible, at least to begin with, but is there anything from there that you've been able to take that's positive from the experience of the pandemic?
Yes, I mean, I think there's been lots of positives and negatives, probably. I mean, teaching on Zoom was definitely a challenge, especially because most of our students and myself were in our living rooms where there simply wasn't enough space to probably kick your leg out to the side without knocking something off the shelf. I mean, I used to push our dining room table into our kitchen, climb back underneath the table, set it up as a little mini studio with a portable bar, and you know, that was life for 3 months in the first lockdown. And I think especially by the time we got to the third lockdown, students and teachers alike were finding it very difficult because we'd all had a bit too much screen time. So I think from a negative point of view, the lack of space, also on Zoom there's a sound delay, so obviously with dance, it's so important to have that connection between the music and the dance. And then I was watching lots of different dancers on my screen, all dancing at different times. Mm. And I then realised I couldn't comment on the musicality. But I think because we had a lack of space, actually, as teachers, we did learn certain aspects of teaching, with particular things like, for example, a technique of arms and the shaping of arms. We spent more time focusing on those parts of the technique that we could, like arms and artistry more so as well. So I guess from that point of view, we learnt new techniques, and as you say, we learnt new teaching techniques as well, because you obviously had to convey it in a different way. You wouldn't always be able to demonstrate it. I think as teachers, we became much better as probably at explaining as well too. Mm. But I think, particular parts of classical technique for me probably was the one area where it became a positive, because I learnt different ways in which to teach it, because we simply had to. Mm. I mean, we gave our students a lot of online resources through Google Classrooms. And I think that was something as well that we've carried on now. We sort of give out handouts in class, and that sort of works. And it makes them appreciate the subject as a all-round subject rather than just the actual physical side of dance as well. So it gave them little challenges, which was quite interesting.
Yeah, and you just made me think that during lockdown, sometimes I was even in this office when we were able to return, but the teaching was still virtual for another year or so. And I remember the students were there, but I couldn't always see them because they'd have their cameras off. But I would just be, for 2 hours or however long the session was, watching myself on the screen. Mm. So I think also that helped in terms of my, some of the work that I'm doing now, which is in front of a camera, because I was watching myself teach. And sometimes I was thinking, gosh, do I look like that? That's how the students see me. Yes. So it just made me a bit more self-critical in a way that can only be positive in terms of the way I present myself. And now we have to, for the last 5 or 6 years, we've always filmed or recorded our lectures, but they used to be audio only. Since the pandemic, I always have the camera on because I'm now completely used to that, and I think that probably is the same for a lot of teachers.
Yes, it's very true. No, it is very true. It's not that I think I'd happily go back to it unless I really had to again.
No, that's the other side. But you mentioned, like, your husband does live theatre. Was there a point during the pandemic when you were thinking, will we ever return to the physical spaces that we'd known?
Absolutely. No, absolutely, because before the pandemic, because he's a touring stage manager, he'd be on a, say, 3-6 month tour, sometimes longer. He'd get home for a couple of days, but obviously we'd be apart for quite a few, weeks of the year. So that was strange for us, because suddenly we were in the same house together every day, and that was a novelty, and that was great. And actually that could have gone one of two ways, but we were very lucky. We loved it, and we got into our own little routine, and he found it quite exciting helping me set up for the Zoom. But I mean by the end of the first lockdown, and then obviously things started to progress, but then theatres couldn't go back because the audiences had to be socially distanced, and that created other problems within theatre. And then he was off work in the end for 18 months and got to the point literally where he thought, no, actually, I might not go back into theatre. And that for him, it would be like for me, somebody saying to me, you can't go back into dance. I mean, that was awful. Mm. And he'd just got a job doing something completely different when literally then, things started to open up, and then he got another touring job for 12 months. And then after that, he was very busy touring, because a lot of people in theatre, as they are in dance and teachers, have actually left the industry because they've realised that actually it's not as stable a job as perhaps they thought, because a lot of people obviously in the dance and theatre world are self-employed and freelance. Yeah. So we don't have, obviously all the advantages that maybe employed people in other businesses have.
No, that's a really good point, because at the beginning of lockdown, a lot of, I thought, who would want to change their jobs, during the pandemic? Because, what jobs are there going to be when you're stuck in your houses? But a lot of people in my profession, not necessarily because of the pandemic, but the pandemic might have heightened a process or sped up a process that would have happened anyway, and they left. But it sounds like it was an opportunity for some people to think, am I on the right path? Is this the right thing for me? Mm. I'm not nostalgic for lockdown.
I
can put that, very starkly. I mean, nostalgia might be my thing, but I think when you're going through something, whether it's something you would ever want to re-experience.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. I don't think I'm very nostalgic about it either, although you talk about positives coming from it, and I think actually in some ways it has done me as a person a few favours, because I think I'm a lot more relaxed than I probably was before the pandemic, I think. Although probably sometimes too relaxed, my timekeeping is probably not as good as it used to be because I've got used to that. But I think we've all learned perhaps to value, you know, family time and other things in life that we missed out on for obviously all those months a little bit more. So I guess the positives, you know, from the pandemic are those sort of things. But no, I agree with you. I wouldn't want to.
Well, as we start to wrap up, I've got a few more questions. Mm-hmm. And I always at this point ask that sort of question. It's an unfair question, really, because it's like looking back on your whole life and career, are your memories predominantly positive? But would you say that, you know, the whole, I mean, you mentioned the pandemic, but this whole interplay between, you know, where you are now, where perhaps you once saw yourself as being and what you're doing, do you sort of look back and think, you know, you've already answered this in terms of the whole thing about fate or destiny, but do you sort of see this all as being quite a positive journey?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I would never, I don't think, want to go back and look at any part of my career, to be honest, again. I mean, obviously it's had its highs and lows. I've been lucky as a dancer, I haven't had many injuries like some dancers have. So, and I love teaching and I just find it really rewarding. And I think because it's not just about physically teaching dance, it's, as you say, seeing the children that I've worked with most of the time actually literally growing up from being a toddler up to being, you know, adults before they leave us. And I think for me, that's really rewarding. So I think, yes, it has been a positive experience. I wouldn't really want to change anything about it.
No, absolutely. And also, as I mentioned, that, you know, that whole thing about negative experiences and the lockdown is an obvious one. Mm. But it's interesting that, and even though I said, and perhaps I was joking a bit when I said it, that, well, I certainly don't want lockdown ever to return, but I will never be nostalgic for it. But it did speed up and expedited things that perhaps would have happened anyway. Like if we hadn't had the pandemic, perhaps even now we'd be learning about this new thing called Zoom or Teams. Mm. And you know, all the meetings were always physical. I don't think I ever used Skype, maybe twice in my life before lockdown. Yeah. That was supplanted very quickly by Teams and Zoom. And so I suppose there are things I do now. It means I can interview people for this podcast all over the world. Yes. Just by sitting in my office or in my bedroom or wherever I might be. So there are definite pluses in that respect.
Yeah, no, there are. And I think as well with the pandemic, I think, and what I like about teaching is being able to touch people's lives in different ways. And I think during the pandemic especially, although people, the children in particular, when they were homeschooling as well online, got very fed up with screen time, actually it was other contact apart from obviously their family members, and that was important to so many, especially the teenagers. And even now coming back into the studio, that's a really important part of it, is the social aspect as well, being able to help families sometimes and children who have anxieties and helping to build their confidence. So it's I think it's just such a rewarding thing to be able to do teaching full stop, no matter the subject really. But
and I've just realized that you've actually answered a question I was going to ask about this whole thing about what your younger self would have imagined you doing now. And of course it's unusual thing. There haven't been too many people I've interviewed who would say that, yeah, the journey that they expected or hoped they'd be on at a very young age is one they followed through on. I love that idea of circuitous journeys. And I suppose I've taken one myself because I've been in academia for decades, and yet there was always something else that I wanted to do, but never lost sight of, and kind of almost doing it through, well, I am doing it through my job because a lot of the media stuff is all in one way or another sanctioned through the work. But that sort of like the conversation between the adult self and the younger self. Could you imagine what sort of advice you'd give your younger self, or what advice your younger self would give yourself now? An impossible question, of course, but I love that whole notion of sometimes trying to imagine at different stages of our lives what advice we'd give ourselves.
I think me talking now as an adult back to my younger self, I probably would say to myself that actually I should have, if anything, been slightly more confident at a younger age and sort of grasped any opportunity without hesitating, I think, probably as a younger student. That's hard. Obviously, that comes with confidence and with experience. I think just grab everything. And I always say this to students, any opportunity you're offered, just say yes, because I think that's so important. Mm. But I think I've got to the point in my career as well where obviously a dancer's body gets older. I'm slightly adapting how I teach now, because obviously physically it's going to get more and more demanding the older I get. Not that I'm like to say I'm that old just yet, but I am going to get there.
Well, you're definitely the youngest person in this room.
But then I think, well, that's very kind. But I think, one thing I haven't probably thought about, and I should be telling my older self this now, is actually to be thinking long term ahead as well, because obviously I can carry on teaching, but whether I want to carry on teaching as that type of teacher that can't be as physical as I am, because I've always been quite physical and demonstrated, and I like to be able to do that because I feel that's part of the inspiration as a teacher, whether now, as you know, moving forwards, where that then career wants to. I have other dreams about, probably ridiculous dreams about setting up different arts festivals for children locally, and different things to try and encourage the younger generation now back into the arts more, because I feel perhaps it's somewhere, you know, and it's an area of life where it's slightly, dare I say it, dying, and I think that's really sad.
Well, and that completely, because it's not a secret, because I work in the arts and humanities, and it is, you know, nationally very much, you know, we're going through some pretty precarious times.
So yeah, so I sort of have a few projects in my mind where I'd like love to be able to do it. Whether that will come to fruition ever, I don't know, but maybe maybe when the teaching sort of, you know, slackens off a little bit, perhaps that's something I can look into, because now I feel I've gained, well, what, 22 years experience that has sort of stood me in good stead, and I've worked with different, you know, experiences and organised different things, and perhaps I can put that experience into different channels as well.
Well, and my very last question, which again I feel you've kind of answered, is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
I knew you were going to ask me this question, and I think a little bit of both, if I'm being honest. It's funny, I like to think of myself as a positive person and like to think that I can think ahead, but I'm terrible at planning ahead, if I'm being honest with myself. So I'm probably more of a nostalgic person. I tend to look back more because I think you can learn a lot from looking back. Obviously, I do look forward, and I have to say I've got potential plans for the future, but I think probably a little bit of both, but more so probably looking back, actually.
Well, this is hugely inspiring for me, because I've learned so much, not least if you have a dream, and I always did have a dream, but I didn't do what you've just advised, and your advice is exactly what I would give my younger self, so note to self. But very, very clear. But Katie, wonderful, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Pleasure, thank you, it's been very enjoyable.